president wants to spy on 200 million Americans without a warrant. Has he read this document, which he was sworn to uphold?
Now, I will not have you libel Abraham Lincoln.
I don't understand the problem with registering guns. We register cars.
Mark Levine brings you the news the government doesn't want you to know.
Today, an explosive story about connections between white supremacists and Islamic terrorists.
When there's a conflict between Scalia's conservative values and the Constitution of the United States, he throws away the Constitution.
When we do have secret prisons, that is not what America's all about.
Let's go to Mark in 5, 4, 3, 2.
Hello, America, and welcome to the Inside Scoop. Today, all the world, I think, is fixated on what's going on in the streets of Tehran, Iran. It's not only Tehran, of course. It's also in several other cities across the country. But in the capital of Tehran, hundreds of thousands of people are marching in the streets and marching for freedom. It may not be the specific kind of freedom we'd want, but it's a lot better than the theocratic dictatorship under which they're living. And the question is, what should U.S. policy be? I would argue that all people of good minds, good hearts and minds, whether they be liberal or conservative, Democrats and Republicans, are on the side of the Iranian people in the streets. Although I have to admit, not everyone is. I did a show on Pacifica just this week where someone from the far left actually didn't seem to be that supportive. We may talk about that in the broadcast. But the great majority of Americans are on the side of the Iranian people. The question is not, whose side are we on? The question is, what should we do? What should President Obama do? What should he say? How do we help the people of Iran obtain some kind of democracy and at the same time not be seen as meddling in Iranian affairs so that the theocratic dictatorship in charge can use us as an excuse to oppress their own people? That's one big issue. The other big issue facing, policymakers this week, completely different subject, but it has to do with health care. President Obama's plan, the Democrats' plan, is starting to wend its way through the houses of Congress. How much will doctors have to give up? Hospitals have to give up? How much will you save? How much will this cost? How much do we need health care reform? I think at this point we desperately need health care reform, but my guest today, I suspect, has quite different views on health care reform and maybe evil on Iran. We'll talk about it. He's a frequent guest on the show. His name is Mike Lane. He's Republican strategist. Mike, welcome again to the Inside Scoop.
Mark, it's good to be back. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming. They're completely two different topics, but they are very much on people's minds. Let's just take them one at a time. I don't think we can combine them in any way, shape, or form, at least until we're starting to provide Iranian health care, which even I don't support. Let's talk about the situation in Iran. I have to say, I'm not surprised. Now, maybe I'm bragging here. But it seemed that most of the world was surprised by what's going on in Iran. I was not. I have always known, I talked about it on this show, the fact that Persians, that Iranians, are the most pro-American people outside of Israel in the Middle East. You will not find an Islamic nation that's more pro-American than the people of Iran. In fact, even secular Turkey, which I have a lot of respect for as a democracy, probably doesn't have the pro-American sentiment of Iran. And that's because its rulers have mistreated its people ever since 1979. Now, the old-timers were not too happy with America. As President Obama pointed out in his Cairo speech, we overthrew their democratically elected leader, Mossadegh, back in 1953. This was a decision of President Eisenhower. It was before both your and my time. But that kind of overthrow, installing the Shah, who did torture his own people, and while he was pro-American, was not too kind to his own people, led to the backlash of 1979. Admittedly, after all this trouble as an Islamic dictatorship, the people are angry. They see that this government hasn't achieved much for them, either with human rights or with democracy. They're fighting back against their government. But the concern, as always, is that we be on the right side of history, that we be on the side of the people, but not be seen as taking the kind of imperialist overstretch that we did back in 1953. What do you think is the right message, the right level of intervention that we should do in Iran? I mean, even you aren't claiming we should go in with troops right now, or a coup d'etat, I hope.
Not today.
Not today, okay. Well, so what would you do? What do you think Obama should do and American policymakers should do to show our solidarity with the people, but not at the same time be seen as, well, the oppressor?
Well, Mark, first of all, I think you're right. With the exception of one or two kooks, I think that the American people want to be seen on the side of the Iranian people. And the Iranian people clearly want freedom. They want a much looser government, more individual freedoms over in Iran. And there's no doubt that's where the people want to be. You're also right that the Iranians, historically ethnically Persians, are different from the rest of the Arab
world. They're not Arabs.
They're not Arabs. They're Persians.
Right. It's different people.
And they are.
They're Muslims, but not Arabs.
They are fundamentally much more pro-American than are the Arabs. And so there's an opening here. And that's particularly among, of course, the intellectual set and in the student set and the reformer set and things like that. Now, yes, we have some past sins to pay for that date back some 56 years or 55 years to 1953.
Let me just ask you about the past sins. Do you agree that Obama was correct to mention the past sin, and the greatest past sin was overthrowing this democratically elected leader and installing the Shah? He apologized for that in Cairo. I am glad he did. Do you agree with that?
I don't think it was necessary, no. I think that, in fact, it was. It's water so far over the under the bridge that it ceases really to be relevant in the current debate, except for the theocratic regime in Iran that wants to whip it up and use it as a red herring in terms of trying to trying to brainwash their population into thinking that that this is the current policy of the United States, and that this is what they're in store for if the United States was. In fact, we'll get into this. But for my money, President Obama has not weighed in strongly enough. He has not asserted the moral authority that he should, and yet the theocratic monsters over there, another Ayatollah Khomeini II, is still Khamenei, whatever he wants to call himself. This monster over there is still using the United States and saying that we have trained the terrorists that are over there, conducting the protests and the demonstrations in the street. That it's all the United States' fault, and of course he itemizes each of the European countries as well. And the man is just—he's living in the Stone Age. He needs to go. And now the question is that we can get into: how does he go?
Okay. Well, let's talk about that, because certainly I'm no fan of his. I would love to see a democratic, peaceful Iran. There's nothing I'd love to see more, particularly one of the strong American ally. I mean, there's nothing, I mean, that we could all hope for more than that. But let's stipulate to the fact that Khamenei and his regime, and Ahmadinejad is just a puppet of that regime, will do whatever they can to blame everything wrong that goes on in their country on the United States of America. Well, we'll stipulate to that.
And Europe.
And Europe and Israel, frankly. I have to say, in terms of great Satans, I think they label United States first, Israel second, and Europe third.
We are the great Satan.
Or maybe Israel first and U.S. second. I'm not sure. Right. But they're going to blame everything on us. Mm-hmm. If somebody sneezes and catches a cold in Tehran, that's the fault of the United States of America.
If we're good guys, if we're bad guys, or if we don't even show up to play the game, we will still be blamed for everything.
That's true. However, let me suggest to you that the Iranian people, particularly those in Tehran, and I also think we have to understand there is a distinction here. It's a distinction that I remember very clearly back. I remember very clearly the revolts in Tiananmen Square in 1989. I remember people marching in the streets. I remember my heart being lifted by watching people fight tanks with flowers. I mean, and bicycles. And it was an amazing thing. And the people of Beijing, like the people of Tehran, were sophisticated, were in the know, compared to the rest of their countrymen. And what did the brutal Chinese regime do? They took people from way outside Beijing. They took I don't know what else you call them, peasants, farmers, rural people, people who were not very sophisticated, and they used those people to crack down and to destroy what happened in Tiananmen Square. And I remember very clearly George Bush Sr. not only saying nothing, but actually condemning the people in Tiananmen Square, saying that they were because he wanted to make better relations with China. And I remember how angry I was at George Herbert Walker Bush for doing that at that time. I was very upset. I called my congressman and everything. And I'll be the first to tell you that there are some on my side of the aisle, some, I don't want to call them progressives. They call themselves progressives. I call them leftists, who would be similar, ironically, to George Bush Sr. in thinking that anyone who's opposing American interests is somehow good, which is ridiculous. But at the same time, as my heart goes out to those people, I recognize that there are two Irans. Ahmadinejad probably didn't win this election, but I don't think it's unheard of to suspect that he got 30, 40% And that much of this vote that he won was based on extremely religious, the red state, if you will, of Iran, the religious, conservative Islamic people. The women, the young people, the intellectuals were clearly all for Mousavi, even though, frankly, he's really more of a stalking horse for what they want.
Right.
Than he's not a great guy either.
Mousavi is not the answer.
No, he's a symbol. He was their excuse to go against the regime.
He's a useful idiot, but he's not the answer.
That's exactly right, and we're glad he's there. But I do fear a backlash, and I fear the regime has already taken action, military action. They're already starting to attack their own people. They haven't done it with the level of force the Chinese used in Tiananmen Square yet. I fully expect it to come. I want to know if you expect it to come, too. I fully expect it to come, and I want America to be seen on the right way on this. I don't think the Iran, and I'm saying, it's a long time to say what I'm trying to say, but the point is that the Iranian regime is already not trusted by the Iranian people. I think the Iranian people, particularly in Tehran, are like the people of Beijing, or frankly, like the people of the former Soviet Union. They know to take anything their government says with a grain of salt. They know if Khamenei says that America's causing us to catch colds, that's ridiculous. Maybe the rural people don't know that. The people in Tehran know that. If, however, we act too precipitously, if we act too much to condemn the regime, my fear is that the intellectuals will see that, and their nationalism for Iran will be stronger than their hatred of the regime.
What you're worried about, I think what the president is worried about, Mark, probably the president more so than you, I would imagine.
It sits on his plate. I don't have to deal with it.
What the president is worried about is, as he articulated this morning on CBS Morning News, is that he doesn't want the United States to be used as a foil by the regime to whip up the masses, turn them against the demonstrations for openness and democracy and freedoms and things like that, et cetera. I don't see that as that big a threat. He's walking a tightrope here, and he has to be careful what he says. But what he says is things like, well, we can't really involve ourselves in this, but we can bear witness to what's going on there. Well, okay, so the world watches while Nero fiddles. These people, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity maybe to really change what is going on in Iran, to solve the Iranian problem, which is, does an out of control radical Islamic theocracy get nuclear weapons for the sole intent of destroying the world? We have a chance to stop this now, and the president needs to come down stronger and more visibly on the side of the people. Not against the regime, but on the side of the people. He has to speak to the natural freedoms that they're exercising, that he has to speak to the fact that that everyone yearns to be free, and that we shall be on their side, and that the people who are not on their side are going to be condemned by history.
We have to take a break soon, Mike, but I want to go over some of the things that President Obama has said, because I think he has stood up on the side of the people. It certainly hasn't been Mr. Gorbachev tear down this wall kind of thing. It hasn't been that kind of loudness. But he certainly has said to the regime, you know, let the people speak. Let them say what they need to say. You know, we are on your side. When we come back, I want to talk about specifically what President Obama can do, because I think his fairly limited. Folks, if you want to join in, it's 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. Back after this.
Osama bin Laden calls getting nuclear weapons a religious duty.
Today, materials that can be used to make nuclear weapons are stored in more than 40 countries.
Sometimes protected by just a chain link fence.
Yet not enough is being done to lock down these materials
before terrorists steal them. Why did we learn all this?
My mother.
My son.
My sister-in-law.
Were all murdered September 11th.
Help protect America.
Together we can.
Please join us.
The stem cell issue is being debated throughout the country.
Truth is, most everyone has an opinion, even if they don't know the facts.
Let's stop arguing and start really understanding the potential of stem cell research.
For us and for millions of Americans living with disabilities, get the facts.
Call 1-877-842-3442 for free information from the Stem Cell Research Foundation. That's 1-877-842-3442.
Following the tragic events of September 11th, there have been hundreds of violent attacks against innocent Americans.
Remember what that flag you're waving stands for.
Remember, please stop the hate.
We're stronger when we are united.
Remember. Remember what that flag you're waving stands for.
One nation under God.
Indivisible.
With liberty.
And justice.
For all.
In America, there's either room for everyone or it's not America. Don't pick the wrong fight.
Let's keep America land of the free.
Stop the hate.
Planning a home renovation? Put this at the top of your to-do list.
Because after 10 years, none of you are protected against tetanus and another potentially fatal disease, diphtheria.
A minor injury, such as a cut or a scrape, can put you at risk for a tetanus infection.
And while safety gear offers some protection, an up-to-date vaccination called the TD booster is the best insurance against tetanus.
So get the TD booster. If it's been 10, do it again.
Here again, The Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to The Inside Scoop. We're discussing the situation in Iran, and also we'll get on to health care. Very, very different issues, but both issues, I think, of real concern to Americans. My guest is Mike Lane, Republican strategist. I, of course, am Mark Levine, who used to work for the Democrats. And Mike, I'm trying to figure out how far apart we are. We're going to be very apart on health care. I have no doubt about that. But I think we agree in Iran that what you said before the break, you said this is an event of a lifetime. I agree with you. This is the kind of thing that happens once in a generation. And you and I both want to see the end result, which is a peaceful, democratic Iran that is responsive to the needs of its people and isn't aggressively trying to get nuclear weapons or trying to harm any other nation. You and I, there's nothing more that we would like to see than that.
That would be flipping a coin and getting heads 10 times in a row.
The question is not whether that is a great goal. We both support that goal. The question is, how do we get there? And it seems to me that our little misadventure in Iraq has harmed the American image around the globe. Back in 1989, when the Chinese students were carrying the Statue of Liberty, we couldn't intervene in China either, certainly not. But they understood America as a beacon for democracy. Our image in the Middle East is not that anymore. It's coming back, I think, with President Obama. But we were told by Paul Wolfowitz and Dick Cheney and others that we'd be greeted with flowers when we went to Iraq and got rid of the dictator Saddam Hussein. I didn't see too many roses.
I saw a lot of them, Mark. They were all
the
there.
Kurds gave us a few roses.
Had we handled the aftermath of the war properly, it would have gone more or less the way it was told. But I'll candidly admit, we blew the aftermath.
And my concern is that I remember a different George Bush. No, it was the same George Bush. It was George Bush Sr. again. He never seems to be on the side of popular revolutions. Maybe he was trying to make up for what he did in China. But I remember during the Persian Gulf War, he encouraged the people to rise up. He encouraged the Kurds and the Shias to rise up against Saddam Hussein right after we kicked them out of Kuwait. They rose up. They were brutally mowed down by Saddam Hussein. Tens of thousands were killed. We did nothing but stand by. George Bush Sr. didn't even give them air support. And so you can go to, maybe he was veering from saying nothing about Tiananmen Square. He encouraged uprisings in Iraq, and then there was no backup. And massive amounts of people died. It seems to me that you can go too far in either direction. What specifically do you think Obama should say? I assume you're not saying Obama should do anything. You're not asking him to use weapons of any kind, are you?
No. Look,
it's all words that we're talking about.
I think, from my point of view, and for many people who agree with me, you're using the wrong model in terms of what was effective. We don't look to Tiananmen Square and George Bush's performance. What we look to is the crackdown on solidarity in Warsaw and Ronald Reagan's response on that.
Or Boris Yeltsin in Soviet Union.
Ronald Reagan stood up and very, very vocally on December 23rd in 1981, articulated the principles, which was that we were going to be on the side of the Polish people, and that a brutal crackdown, and he itemized the kinds of things they were doing. And it's not even as bad. I mean, in Iran, they've already, state news has already admitted that they've killed 24 of their own people in demonstrations. They hadn't even killed 24 in Warsaw by the time Ronald Reagan gave his speech. And he gave a very strong speech that I have excerpts with me. We can refer to them. As to why we were standing on the side of the Polish people, why it was important that the Polish people prevail, and why it was important that the government of Poland not regress and go back into the crushive, oppressive regime that was characteristic of a Soviet satellite state prior to that.
And I think what Ronald Reagan did with regard to Poland is a wonderful thing. It's one of the things that I most praise Reagan for. And I there are many domestic things I don't like that Ronald Reagan did, but certainly what he did with regard to Poland was absolutely right. But I would suggest to you, Mike, that there's a difference. And the difference is the history of Poland versus the history of Iran. Poland never had any reason to hate or mistrust the United States of America. Poland had every reason to mistrust the very powerful neighbor to its east and the very powerful neighbor to its west, Stalin and the Nazis. They were repeatedly invaded by the Russians, later the Soviets, by the Nazis. And America never invaded Poland. America never chose the government of Poland. America was clearly a beacon of freedom for Poland. If Germany, for example, who is our ally, Western ally, had been taking the forefront, I think the Polish probably would have responded to Germany, even modern Germany, in the way they responded to modern America. They had a history with Germany. They had no history with America. We could be their beacon of freedom. The same is true for China. Iran, given our history, given that we overthrew the democratic leader, installed the Shah, did so largely to protect oil interests, kept him in power, taught his SAVEK, his secret police, how to torture for 26 years, I realize it's in the past. I realize the Shah hasn't been around since 30 years. I realize that young people are willing to let that water go under the bridge. But there's still enough people that remember the Shah to recognize that I don't know that we can take that kind of stance that Reagan did with Poland.
Mark, what did they do when they were, no one's going to defend the Shah today. It was obvious that he was something of a brutal dictator regime. He oppressed
sure.
his people.
Absolutely he did.
But what they did was, and I think the Iranian people realize this, what they did was, without thinking it through, they traded in a guy who was essentially a minus two on a scale of 1 to 10 for a minus 12 on a scale of 1 to 10.
I agree with you.
They would die to have the freedoms that they had under the Shah.
Certainly the secularists were. I'm not so sure about the theocrats. They actually there are people in Iran who like this regime. I don't want to discount
As you point out, maybe it's 30%.
That's significant.
That's okay. They can pray, they can be holy, but they can't infringe upon the natural God-given freedoms that the Iranian people have and deserve to have and are demonstrating to acquire right now. The real question is, Mark, is are these demonstrators going to be able to prevail without encouragement and help? Or are they going to be crushed by the regime without that encouragement and help? I think they're going to be crushed unless we speak out more forcefully, unless we speak out as strongly as the Canadian Prime Minister, the German Chancellor, the French President, the United States Congress, which has passed very strong resolutions on behalf of the American people. Unless President Obama does that, I think that the Iranian regime is going to be able to successfully crush this this little ember of a fire that could be spread into a wildfire. He ought to be finding ways to fan the flames of this fire, not find ways to just observe it and see what happens.
I think, Mike, you ascribe too much power to our president.
I
really fear that this, I don't know what's going to happen in the future. I fear it may be crushed just like Tiananmen Square. For all that I was angry that George Bush Sr. said the wrong things, and I really think he did say the wrong things in 1989, I am not arguing that George Bush Sr. could have said something that would have caused the students in Tiananmen Square to overthrow the Chinese government. I don't think there was anything we could do in China. I'm not so sure there's anything we could do in Iran.
Well, you call their bluff. Here's the deal. Right now, they have demonstrations that are huge by their standards.
The largest since 1979.
The largest since 79. They're getting, not in the last couple days since they've been mowing them down, but, they used to get anywhere from 100,000 to 300,000 to 400,000 people out in a demonstration, which was huge. And it threatens the government. It threatens this,
No question.
Khomeini,
which is why the government wants to mow them down.
This Khomeini guy. What we do is, the president speaks and he encourages them to come out and fight for their own freedoms. And maybe when we start getting demonstrations regularly that are from 500,000 and up, Then the regime has to make a decision. Are we going to kill in cold blood 500,000 of our own people right here in the streets of Tehran, or are we going to back down?
And you and believe that they're going to listen to the call of President Obama rise up when they wouldn't otherwise?
I think the people in Tehran, if they get the right encouragement, if they see the world community, including the United States, as the moral leader in the world, bringing their plight to the attention of the world and encouraging them to pursue their freedoms, I think they will come out in much larger numbers than they are now, which are already huge. And then the regime has to decide if it's going to define itself. Are they going to reach an accommodation, or are they going to mow down 500,000 of their own people in the
street? I think they're going to mow them down.
But if they do, then we know exactly what they are.
I've always known what they are. I've never doubted.
But the world will know exactly what they are.
And you're right about that. Here's the thing. They know the world is watching. They know. I mean, it's been called the Twitter revolution, right? They know that through mm-hmm. Twitter and YouTube and all these at least in Tehran, they know that the world is behind them. It may not be true in rural Iran, where I really fear the regime will do what they did in China. Let me read to you, and we may go over to the next segment, but I want to read to you a couple things that President Obama has said. This is from, believe it or not, this is from the Wall Street Journal, and it's quoting President Obama, and it says, this is President Obama speaking. What you're seeing in Iran are hundreds of thousands of people who believe their voices were not heard and who are peacefully protesting and seeking justice. And the world is watching. And we stand behind those who are seeking justice in a peaceful way. And you know, already we've seen violence out there. I think I've said this throughout the week. I want to repeat it, that we stand with those who would look to peaceful resolution of conflict, and we believe that the voices of people have to be heard, and that's a universal value that the American people stand for and this administration stands for. You don't think that's sufficient?
Well, it's a nicely written editorial, but I don't think the administration has been vocal enough in standing for that.
That's what President Obama just said.
Those are his words. Those were his words. Okay.
Those are his words. I'm sorry. There's a Wall Street Journal quoting him. These were Obama's words. This is Obama, I didn't mean to mislead you there. This is Obama on CBS News, and they're talking about his quote. But this is what he said is it yesterday? I want to get it right here. June 22nd. What's that? Today. Saturday. So he said this on Saturday. He goes on to say, let me read a little bit more from the quote. This is again what President Obama said Saturday. When we go to the break, we'll come back. He said, but the last point I want to make on this, President Obama said, this is not an issue of the United States or the West versus Iran. This is an issue of the Iranian people. The fact that they are on the streets under pretty severe duress at great risk to themselves is a sign that there's something in that society that wants to open up. I think that's pretty strong language. When we come back, I want you to tell me why you think it's insufficient.
It's pretty mediocre.
And also, I want to give people a chance to call in and express your opinions. What do you think about what's going on in Iran? What do you think President Obama should do? What word should he say? Has he said enough? Do you think he's being too mealy now? Let me know. 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275, and we will get to health care reform in just a few minutes. Back after this.
One day these rats were playing in the woods.
One of some matches and that's no good.
Yeah. Listen to smoke before you give it a try.
Only you.
Don't play with matches. Don't play with fire.
Fire.
Cause there's nothing better for the bar. Drink that money. Nothing very nice.
A homeless man.
So if a gorgeous force is what you desire, don't play with matches.
Don't play with fire.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Fire!
Why don't you just wash your car at home?
When I wash my car, everything runs down the street and down into the storm drains. With all the chemicals and the soaps and waxes, the last thing I want to do is poison my own drinking water.
At least here, it's all contained and recycled on site.
That's why I also take my car in for oil changes instead of doing it myself. I might take a chance on spilling stuff.
You know what the best part is?
What?
More time to kick back and watch the game.
How far would you go to protect the planet?
I want you to build an ark.
Here we go.
Okay, that's good.
Maybe there's another way.
People, the flood is imminent.
Is it too much to ask for a little precipitation?
Go to fightglobalwarming.com to find out what you and your community can do to reduce global warming pollution.
Somewhere around the world, there are men and women of the armed forces risking their lives, helping rebuild communities after natural disasters, collecting toys for needy children, tutoring kids in school. These are your sons and daughters who work to keep us safe, secure, and free. Dedicated men and women who put their country first.
Here again, The Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to The Inside Scoop. We're discussing the situation in Iran with, I'm discussing with Mike Lane, the Republican strategist. I, of course, am a former Democratic lawyer on the Hill. And I'm not so sure we have this much of a disagreement, but he'll let me know in a second. We will get to health care, I promise, before the end of the hour. Mike, I want to read to you a statement by Anthony Cordesman. He's someone who's well-known in the intelligence and national security community. And we could show it up on the screen. He writes, "The situation would be different if the United States or any outside power had a magic wand, or if any of the lies regarding foreign interference being told by Khamenei and Ahmadinejad were true. The fact is, however, that the United States cannot suddenly intervene in Iran. American political rhetoric is not going to change Iranian facts on the ground, and there is no clear opposition outside Iran worth backing." You disagree?
Well, we haven't developed the opposition in Iran over the last 20 years that we should have been developing.
I'm glad we did.
All this time.
You know why?
I give up.
Because the revolution is homegrown. Because this isn't a question of the United States imperialist imposing our people.
But you Mark, know, you have to have an acceptable alternative. And as we've discussed, Mousavi is not the acceptable alternative.
Doesn't matter.
He's
you know
just
why
the stooge.
Not? It doesn't matter. Mousavi has his own past as a prime minister under this regime. He's actually mistreated people. But Mousavi, if he manages to get in, and we both agree it's not about him, will have to respond to this huge wave of public outpouring. He can't rule the way Khamenei has ruled. He won't have power to. He will be beholden to the people. You know, Boris Yeltsin wasn't that big a Democrat either until the people installed him into power. That has a real effect on a man. The point is that because we didn't try, you know, we tried, I remember, with the Iraqi National Congress. We talked with a man named Ahmed Chalabi, and he must have gotten, I don't know how many tens of millions, probably hundreds of millions of dollars from the U.S. taxpayer. He was going to go in. He was going to lead Iraq. He was going to represent American interests. He went to Iraq, and I don't think he got 1% in the elections there, and now we find out he was working for Iran at the time. I don't think when we train these outsiders and install them, and they're not native to the region, that it's anything but an imperialist ploy on our part. The nice thing, the beautiful thing of this Iranian revolution is it's completely grassroots. It's not caused by us, and it makes it more authentic and more likely to hold.
It is grassroots, and that's wonderful, but it has to succeed for it to hold. And I worry that absent encouragement to the Iranian people and pressure from the international community and support from the international community, it's not going to succeed. Let me give you a brief example of some words that I would prefer to hear from the president. I took the liberty of rewriting some of Ronald Reagan's speech from 1981.
Fair enough.
And I will, in probably a minute or less, be able to tell our audience what I'm talking about. And now I'd be quoting what I want President Obama to say. All right. The information we have confirms that the imposition of martial law in Iran has led to the arrest and confinement in prisons and detention camps of thousands of Iranian students, reformers, and intellectuals. Iranian reformers exercising their natural rights of petitioning their government are being beaten and murdered by the security forces. We view the current situation in Iran in the gravest terms, particularly the increasing use of force against an unarmed population and violates the basic civil rights of the Iranian people. Violence invites violence and threatens to plunge Iran into chaos. We call upon the free people to join in urging the government of Iran to reestablish conditions that will make constructive negotiations and compromise possible. Skipping a lot, finally let me say, he should say something like, "This summer, it is freedom and reform that is at stake in Iran. But the torch of liberty is hot. It warms those who hold it high, and it burns those who try and extinguish it." That's the kind of rhetoric I would like to see the president use.
You know, I wouldn't be opposed to that kind of rhetoric being used. I really wouldn't, because he's making clear that he's on the side of the people, not the regime. What I fear, though, is that sort of the way the neoconservatives approached Iraq, the idea that we're going to install or we're going to get some kind of American or that we're going to have some, you know, pro-American guy worm their way in there. As long as we are supporting Iranian elements, I'm all for it. You know, I got to tell you, people think that I wasn't for the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. They're wrong. Back during the Gulf War, I firmly supported the overthrow of Saddam Hussein by Iraqis, by the people that were rising up, and frankly, in call to George Bush Sr. They rose up, and we didn't support them. Supporting native people overthrow their own dictators is precisely what I think America is all about.
Mark, we're at a situation, as we've agreed, this is a once-in-a-generation or a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I use the metaphor of the surfer sitting out there waiting for the big wave. You know, it's coming, it's coming. If he catches that wave, it changes history. If he doesn't catch that wave, it's gone forever. And I think this is the wave that the president needs to proactively go out there and make sure he catches.
I'm not sure we can make that much of a difference. I firmly fear a very dramatic crackdown. Since neither of us believe that the United States should use force of arms here, we're only talking about gradations in rhetoric. I have no problem stepping up the rhetoric. I think you're going to see, as more and more people go out in the street, President Obama stepping up the rhetoric, and I have no problem with that. And our producer says that we're agreeing too much, so I think we should move on to healthcare.
Fair enough. Sorry, Mr. Producer.
Well, we will definitely disagree. Hey, you know, what can I say? When you're right, you're right. And I don't know. When I see the people in the street, it just sends chills up my spine. And I don't care whether it's China or Iraq.
These people want freedom for themselves.
Risking their lives to do it.
They want to help themselves.
Absolutely.
We should help them help themselves.
We should. Since it's only through words, it's a very subtle difference. But let's go on to healthcare, because I think the biggest fight that President Obama will face is not the stimulus package, it's not bank bailouts, it's not the economy, it's not foreign policy, it's not Iran, it's not even, though I think it's going to be big, the cap and trade, the environment. The biggest fight he's going to face in his entire first term, barring some event that none of us have foreseen, I believe, is healthcare. Poor Harry Truman tried really hard to reform the system and did not succeed. Hillary Clinton famously tried, did not succeed. I'm going to go on a limb, though, and say that President Obama has the best chance of success in reforming health care, better than Truman, better than Hillary Clinton. I think he's going to succeed, and I'll tell you why. I think he's going to succeed because I think President Obama has gotten everyone in a room, not just the uninsured, who obviously very much need the help, not just ordinary Americans who are sick and tired of their having to call on the phone to their health management organization, begging them to have some life-saving test that they don't think will save lives. But he's talked to doctors, he's talked to hospitals, he's talked to pharmaceutical companies, he's even talked to insurance companies and tried to make everyone play their part. And as long as everyone can get in a room, and it may not be pretty, you know, they say you shouldn't watch legislation or sausage being made, but the idea to have a public option, a private option, let them compete as they will, let the best team win, I'm confident the government will win, because I think, as we've seen in Canada and England and France, the people are very happy with their system. I'm confident the rich can still pay for that 93-year-old that needs that heart transplant if she's got, you know, $10 million to pay for. But at the end of the day, that is the direction we're going. And I know you folks are going to try to stop it. I don't think you'll succeed.
Well, Mark, you're right. We moved on to a subject where we're going to have more disagreement than the first one. Let's see. I think that President Obama's problems on this are not the Republicans. President Obama's problems on this are the Democrats. He can't get a majority of the Democrats. Or he can get a majority, but he can't get
60.
He can't get 50 Democrats at this point to be on board with what he's trying to do. There are a number of things going on. The first is, let's talk about all the groups in the room. Yes, all the groups went in the room and they're all talking, but they're there because they're afraid not to be there.
That's right.
And they know that their ox is going to get gored, but eventually what's going to happen is they're all going to come together and they're going to realize that, you know what, this is just ruining healthcare in America. It's ruining us. So the hospitals, the doctors, the insurance companies, they're all going to pull out and they're all going to oppose it the way they did back in 1993 with Hillary Care, and I think ultimately it's going to go down. Now, there may be some compromise someplace, but here's the sticking points. The sticking points is, number one, the cost. Number two, the relative little amount that it does in terms of gaining coverage for people who don't have coverage. And number three, the the public government option. There's just not going to be enough votes for a government option. You have to find some other way to skin that cat.
I would suggest to you that President Obama is studying 1993 very closely, following it from beginning to end, not making the mistakes that Hillary Clinton made. One of the large criticisms that people in your party made, and it was a fair criticism, was she did too much in secret, that she did too much of the process behind closed doors. Same reason I didn't like Dick Cheney talking to all those oil companies. I don't trust an energy policy behind closed doors, and Americans didn't trust a healthcare policy behind closed doors. This is the most open, transparent process we've ever seen. It's why so many people are grumbling about this specific little thing and this specific little thing. I also think we're in a difference from 1993 because in 1993, health management organizations were fairly new. The idea of healthcare for profit, the idea of making huge amounts off denying people care, was a new idea. And I think people at the time, I mean, you probably saw doctors making house calls in 1993.
I don't think it was quite that reason.
Well, maybe not. But the point is, we're in a very different place now. I think the vast majority of Americans believe we need healthcare reform. And anytime you have a choice, anytime you make a public policy, some people say, well, if we just refuse it, that's not a choice. That is a choice. You are choosing between the status quo and Obama's plan. And if you are rejecting Obama's plan, what you're doing, Mike, is you're defending the status quo. And no. I think most Americans don't support the status quo.
Let's go through the three big problems with the Obama plan, or Obama Kennedy, or Kennedy Dodd, or whatever you want to call it.
Healthcare reform.
The three big things are, number one, the cost. CBO just scored it last week. For people who don't know the jargon, that means they analyzed it and figured out what the Congressional Budget Office was going to analyze and decide how effective it was going to be in doing what it was going to do. And they came up with three things. Number one, it was going to be an entry-level $1 trillion just to get started. The second thing was of the always thrown around but never proven 48 million people who are without health insurance at this time, health coverage, that it was only going to cover 12 million of them. There are still going to be 36 million people who would not get coverage after we spent the $1 trillion. And then the third thing was that a minimum of 23 million people who were happy with their current coverage were going to be forced out of their plans, had their doctors taken away, and go someplace else. So, you know, with those kind of numbers as the entry level, of course, you know, people who are opposed to the concept of the government competing with and trying to put private health insurance plans out of business, you know, you've got the perfect wave here coming, Mark. There's no way of getting over this thing.
Now, was it Mark Twain that said there were liars, damn liars, and then there were statistics? I mean, you I think, have cherry-picked that CBO finding just as much as Dick Cheney did the stuff in Iraq. Look, one thing that the Congressional Budget Office doesn't do is they don't speculate. They don't speculate on cost savings in the future. They're not allowed to do that by statute. They only look at hard costs. And yet, we know for a fact that every single Western nation who has single payer, who has government-run health care, pays way less than we do. We pay 50% more per capita than Canada, than England, than France, than Germany, than any other Western nation on earth. And I don't think the Canadians are living under a terrible health care scheme. I don't see Canadians dying early. In fact,
they
we
do.
Have more infant mortality. We have more mistakes. We have a lower life expectancy than in Canada or England or France or any of these Western nations that have health care. Now, they're doing something right.
Not much.
Well, the people there like it, and they're very happy with it.
The people there don't really like it. Look,
They used to have private health care. This is not something that just sprung upon them from the beginning of time.
I'm going to tell you about your buddy Robert Gibbs, who, as people know, is the spokesman
secretary
for the White House, the press secretary. He's the guy that makes Scott McClellan look good. And, you know, Scott McClellan, hardly anybody could make him look good. He was so awful. Anyway.
Poor Robert Gibbs.
The president gave his speech to the AMA. And in his speech, he said, now there are some places where single payer works. And he went right on. The next day, Gibbs was asked, what nations was the president referring to? And Gibbs says, well, I don't know. I can't name any.
We have to take a break. Pace, Robert Gibbs, I want to hear from you. 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. We'll be right back after this.
This year, 28,000 Americans will be diagnosed with oral cancer. Every year, 7,000 Americans die of oral cancer.
I'm Eva Cohen, and I'm an oral cancer survivor. I didn't fit the profile. I didn't smoke or drink. I had no family history of cancer. No family history of cancer. I was 31 years old. 31 years old. I went to see my dentist about a sore in my mouth that wouldn't heal. It was oral cancer. I had to have a radical neck dissection and a portion of my tongue reconstructed. I didn't know if I was going to live or die.
I'm Surgeon General Richard Carmona. The survival rate for oral cancer is only 50%. Oral cancer can happen to anyone. If you have a sore or lesion in your mouth that doesn't heal within 2 weeks, see your dentist. Early detection is the key.
Early detection saves lives. I know.
One in eight Americans goes hungry. One idea helped change that. A community started a garden that blossomed into farmers markets. One in six children lives in poverty. One group of women found an answer by opening a daycare center that their neighbors could afford. Today, 36 million Americans live in poverty. But one by one, people are helping themselves and each other to change the picture of poverty to one of hope. For easy ways you can help, visit povertyusa.org.
Two words for you. Pop quiz. Ready? Name any funny movie. A drama. Name a mystery. And one more thing. Name the movie your kids saw today in science class.
Know what really matters. Know about your kid's school. And know about your kid. Find out 100 ways to know more, do more.
Here again, The Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to The Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, former congressional attorney for the Democrats on Judiciary Committee and Homeland Security Committee. My guest is a frequent contributor to The Inside Scoop, the other side of the aisle, Mike Lane. He's a Republican strategist. We're talking about health care. And the point I've been trying to make, Mike, is that the decision to do nothing is also a decision. If you do nothing, you are saying, in effect, that you're fine with the current system, that you think healthcare is just fine in America, that we, being the only Western nation that has tens of millions of people who are uninsured, is just fine, that having so many mistakes being made, so many unnecessary tests, so much money going, frankly, to emergency care because the uninsured aren't covered, because we won't pay $100 for their heart medicine, they go in for emergency care, and now we have to pay for their quintuple heart bypass, which is a lot more expensive. You know, that might cost $50,000, whereas the heart medication would have cost $100. The current system isn't working. You don't dispute that, do you?
There are problems with the current system. Let's talk about three things that actually the Republicans do have a plan now.
And they do.
They've actually got.
You're kidding.
No, they do. It's a great plan.
It's just say no.
But no. They have three things that strike me. There's actually about six or seven things in their plan, but there's three things that strike me that would go a long way. The first is that you eliminate discrimination for prior conditions. You know, there's no turning anybody down. Republicans and Democrats probably agree on that. You know, we could get that done tomorrow. No more excluding people for prior conditions. The second thing that the Republicans would do is the thing that Obama almost started to say in front of the AMA and then said, oh, but I'm not going to tell you that. And that is a reform of the tort system and the crazy lawsuits and things like that that are just out of whack. It does two things. Number one, it drives up the cost of insurance for doctors, and that has to be included in their medical fees. And the second thing it does is it makes them practice defensive medicine and has them order seven tests when maybe three would do or something like that. So Republicans and Democrats can't agree on that because you guys are owned lock, stock, and barrel by the trial bar. Then the third thing that's in the Republican plan is escaping my brain at this minute.
Let's talk about the two you dealt with.
All right,
You'll come up with the third one. Let's talk first of all about prior conditions. I think if you look at Michael Moore's movie on the healthcare system, anyone in America, you know that is in a real extreme problem, that people who have prior conditions, they can't even change jobs. They have a job, and if they try to change their job, they lose their health care. We've got to do something about that. But in requiring everyone to be covered who had prior conditions, there's a free rider problem. Free rider is a wonderful economic term, but it happens all the time. Free rider is basically you get someone else to pay for your things. In other words, if you got your neighbor to build a nice green space like a park and you don't pay for it, and then you get to use the park, or you get the highway. It's a way of basically saying that you have this public good, and then you can just glom onto it without paying for it. The problem is that people might be completely healthy, and oh, I don't need health care, I'm completely healthy. Then I develop cancer, and now suddenly, because they can't restrict me for pre-existing conditions, I can join the plan, and having never paid insurance for 20 years, now I want the best care because I have leukemia, and yet I for those 20 years, I wasn't paying into the system. Mm-hmm. What Obama does is requires everyone to pay into the system, everyone to put in their place, and that way we got to cover people with pre-existing conditions. I'm glad you agree with me on that, but we can't have this moral hazard of people saying, I'm healthy, I don't need health insurance, oh boom, I'm sick, give me the Cadillac coverage.
I think there's room for discussion on a mandate requirement that people...
That you'd agree to?
Well, I said there's room for discussion.
There's
really? Room for discussion on a mandate that everyone provide themselves with a catastrophic policy.
And if they don't, the government will provide it for them.
No, I don't know that there's room for the government to provide that. But people should be required to provide themselves, you know, an individual. Healthcare is a responsibility, Mark. It really is. And people, you know, ought to behave in a responsible manner. And if you're young and you're healthy and you're bulletproof and you don't think you're going to, you're going to get the flu every week or something like that, well, that's fine. You can pay out of pocket for the flu when you get it or whatever it is.
You would even tax them to pay for this.
But for catastrophic things, I think that, you know, people, you know, ought to cover, they ought to indemnify society against paying their costs for catastrophic.
And you'd be willing to tax people for this.
No, I think
I use that three-letter word that Republicans make them all run away.
People ought to be required to do it. I'm willing to discuss. I don't have all the details yet.
And obviously, we have to do something for the people.
I'll sit in the conference room with you, and I'll work out a plan.
And you won't deny that there are people that can't afford even that minimum coverage, and for that, the government has to provide them. I mean, you're not going to let people die because they can't afford health care.
There may be other ways, but the government already provides policies along that line. So
a little bit of Medicaid is not enough. Yeah. Let me go to your second issue, the tort system. And you may be surprised that I'm willing to sit in your room with you on this. One of the things I think we learned in setting up workers' compensation, which is a very old program, it dates back many years, is that there can be, for example, safety hazards in the workplace that you don't want to have, but at the same time, you can have a system to prevent sort of catastrophic damage awards. My concern has to do with the doctors regulating themselves. If we are going to protect them from malpractice, we need to have better regulation of doctors. There's this tradition. The AMA, doctors regulate themselves, just like lawyers, ABA regulate themselves. I'm not so sure either can do it very well. To me, it's kind of a one-strike, you're out rule. If you have committed some kind of awful malpractice, you shouldn't be practicing medicine again. And we have, one of the things that's interesting to me, and I'd like to know your explanation, is even with this, the tort system we have, our doctors in America make more mistakes and cause greater injuries that are unintended than in Canada, and in England, and in France, three countries with government-run healthcare. And I would suggest to you that part of the reason for that is this amalgam of crazy, this insurance company requires this, this insurance coverage requires this, this one requires this kind of paperwork, this hospital requires this. There's not one standard set of regulations. In England, France, and Canada, the government sets regulations, you follow these standards, and you won't be sued because you're what they call a safe harbor in the law. You've done what you're supposed to do. Now we have such an amalgam of rules and regulations. I would suggest you we could fix the tort system by having safe harbors that are given by government regulation.
Well, I'll sit in the room and I'll talk to you about that.
Okay.
But I'll come up with the third item which addresses part of that. And that is that right now, as you know, the insurance company is a very probably overregulated industry. And one of the things that that we find is that they're regulated state by state, part of McCarran-Ferguson. And
I'd get rid of that.
So
I'd federalize it.
What the Republicans would like to do is to amend that so that plans can cross state lines and not be regulated federally rather than by each individual state.
That way you have a race to the bottom. That's great. That way, if Wyoming says, oh, we have no standards at all, then they can provide the cheapest plans, and then, hey, you're a big corporation who you don't control. They can choose the Wyoming plan.
They can already do this. What I'm saying is you're not, you know, we're going to let plans cross state lines, but not go along with the state standards on that. We're going to allow, if you cross state lines, then it will be a federal standard.
Excuse me. I'm okay with that.
And you can create bigger plans.
I'm okay with that. As long as you have a federal standard. Because I know that whether it's Delaware and corporations or South Dakota and credit cards, if the lowest state regulation makes the lowest standard, I'm very skeptical. But that federal standard, that addition that you made,
if you're crossing state lines, you're not licensing yourself in Wyoming and then crossing state lines.
All right,
that's not the answer.
I can agree with that. We're finding more agreement here than they are on the Hill.
We're not going to spend $1 trillion to only cover 12 million people and leave 36 million uninsured.
First of all. One thing you're not considering, there's two things you're not considering, is the tremendous costs we can save. And let me tell you where they're going to come from.
Out of doctors' pockets.
I'll tell you where it's going to come from.
All right.
It's going to come from insurance company pockets, and it's going to come from pharmaceutical company pockets, and let me tell you how. Okay, insurance companies, I would suggest to you, are the lion's share of the difference between American healthcare costs and other Western nations. Ours are 50% higher than theirs. And I think that's because about a third of American costs go to paper pushers who are trying to handle 287 different regulations from various states and insurance companies. That's why I support a federal standard. And insurance companies and doctors and hospitals, and they have to keep Kaiser's planned along with each of the others, that we get rid of the middleman. Now, I know the insurance companies don't want to hear that. I got a cousin who pushes health insurance, and I got to tell you, he's a firm Republican. He loves it because he makes money off of people's misery. We have disagreements on this.
He would call himself a consumer patient advocate.
Well, he may call himself whatever he wants, and he's my cousin, and I'm not going to attack him too strongly. But my point is that if we cut out the middleman, we save a lot of money. The other place we save a lot of money, pharmaceutical companies. Canada learned something that I think Americans already know, which is that when you have a big entity, the government, and they can negotiate with pharmaceutical companies, you can get big savings. It's the same difference between unions and employers. You got an employer and you have workers that aren't in a union, they can discriminate against everyone, just like the pharmaceutical companies. You can't have mom and pop Smith fight big pharma, but the government is big enough to fight back, just like a union's big enough to fight back against an employer. We can lower those costs, and they won't be spending all this money on Viagra ads. They'll be spending it on a cure.
The first thing, I don't want my government fighting against any private company, okay? I just find that to be abhorrent, that my government would fight to put a private company out of business because they think they can undercut their price.
I think Canadians are still buying drugs. I don't think they're out of business.
No, I'm talking about the health plans.
I know what I'm talking about.
The health plan. You know, the government is going to put the health plans out of business.
Oh, the insurance companies.
Yeah, exactly.
The blacksmith is gone too. When they built the roads at the interstates, the horseshoe manufacturers, they lost their jobs.
There are over 1,300 health plans in this country. You know, the competition is there. We don't need the government coming in with predatory pricing and putting these plans out of business for the sole purpose of taking over the government healthcare system.
If these plans can compete and do a better job than the government, then let them do it, and they can't.
The government will subsidize it, and they'll come in, they'll lowball it, and immediately you're going to put two-thirds of the private plans out, and people are going to lose their doctors, and they're going to lose their health coverage.
Since they can't, we're going to save a lot of money, and no one's going to lose their doctors.
Everyone will lose their doctors. This is a debate
that will continue into the summer. Mike and I will have it, I'm sure, on this very topic again. Mike,
pleasure, Mark.